And here is the Vegan's Almanac for today, the 17th of May. We're celebrating World Eel Day today, a question that stumped Aristotle and countless successors throughout the history of natural science was, where do eels come from? The German biologist Max Schultz, lying on his deathbed, observed that he was leaving a world where all the important questions had now been settled, all of them, that is, except the eel question. People found eels in brooks, rivers, lakes, and the sea. They also found them inexplicably in ponds that dried out and refilled each year and that had no access to other bodies of water. They couldn't help but notice that the creatures seemed to have no ovaries, no testicles, no eggs, and they were never observed mating. The ancient Egyptians believed that eels were produced by the sun warming the Nile. Aristotle decided that eels emerged spontaneously from mud and rainwater. Pliny the Elder thought that new eels developed when old eels rubbed away parts of their bodies on rocks. As late as the 1860s, a Scottish author espoused the belief that they began their lives as beetles. In the English countryside, most people adhered to the theory that eels were born when hairs from horses' tails fell into the water. The truth emerged only slowly and was, in its own slippery way, stranger than the fiction. Careful observers discovered that what had long been taken for several different kinds of animals were in fact just one. Eels are creatures of metamorphosis, transforming themselves over the course of their lives into four distinct beings. Tiny gossamer larvae with huge eyes floating in the open sea, shimmering glass eels known as elvers, a few inches in length with visible insides, making their way along coasts and up rivers. Yellow-brown eels, the kind you might see in ponds, who can move across dry land, hibernate in mud, and live quietly for half a century in a single place. And finally, the silver eels, long, powerful muscles that ripple their way back to sea. When this last metamorphosis happens, the eels' stomachs dissolve. They will travel thousands of miles on their fat reserves alone, and their reproductive organs develop for the first time. Unlike most fish, many eels spend much of their adult lives in freshwater rivers and streams and return to the oceans where they were first born to spawn and then die. There are about 800 species of eels characterized by their elongated worm-like bodies. Unlike most fish, eels do not have pelvic fins, and most species do not have pectoral fins. Eels have a continuous dorsal, anal, and caudal fin that runs around the tail tip. To swim, eels generate waves that travel the length of their bodies. To swim backwards, they reverse the direction of the wave. The body covering of an eel is typically scaleless. Their color ranges from drab gray or black in deep sea species to colorful and patterned in tropical reef species. Their diet typically consists of smaller fish, invertebrates, crustaceans, shrimp, crabs, and sea urchins. Freshwater eels also consume insect larvae. Most eel species are nocturnal. They typically feed at night and hide under rocks, logs, and mud of the water's bottom during the daytime. While most eels are solitary during their juvenile and adult life, some eel species, such as garden eels, live together in vast colonies of several hundred individuals in tropical reef areas. It's the birthday of Dr. John McDougall, born on this day in 1947. Dr. John McDougall was a physician, speaker, and best-selling author who taught the importance of a whole foods, plant-based diet in order to halt, reverse, and heal chronic disease. He co-founded the McDougall Program alongside his wife, Mary McDougall, creator of thousands of low-fat, oil-free vegan recipes. And here's a poem for today, The Mystery by Gilbert Keith Chesterton. If sunset clouds could grow on trees, it would but match the May in flower. And skies be underneath the seas, no topsy-turvier than a shower. If mountains rose on wings to wander, they were no wilder than a cloud. Yet all my praise is mean as slander, mean as these mean words spoken aloud. And never more than now I know that man's first heaven is far behind, unless the blazing seraph's blow has left him in the garden blind. Witness, O sun that blinds our eyes, unthinkable and unthinkable king, that though all other wonder dies, I wonder at not wondering. The Mystery by Gilbert Keith Chesterton. This has been the Vegan's Almanac with the reminder to marvel at the world's many mysteries today. Welcome to Animalia Hour, a full hour of news and stories related to non-human animals, as well as the joyful and healthful benefits of plant-based eating. I am your host, Sarah Hale. Thank you for being here. And today, I think we're going to be able to finish Howard Lyman's book, Mad Cowboy, Plain Truths from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat. We're finishing up chapter eight, Skip the Miracles and Eat Well. And we'll read the last chapter, which is very short, chapter 9, Going Home. I'm often struck by a phenomenon in the media. Quite frequently, there is news of a breakthrough in medical understanding of the role of some nutrient in our diet. One day, it might be the finding that cruciferous vegetables play an important role in preventing cancer. Another might bring the news that antioxidant-rich foods such as raisins, sesame seeds, and green and orange vegetables prevent cholesterol from oxidizing and turning dangerous. Or that genistein found in soybeans inhibits the growth of tumors. Or that apple skin, red wine, and purple grape juice are all good for dilating blood vessels and protecting the heart. Or that onions and garlic provide a world of health benefits, fighting viruses, cancer, high blood pressure, and cholesterol. Or that fiber lowers serum cholesterol. Or that saponins, a class of compounds found in fruits and vegetables, stimulate the immune system and may have anti-tumor properties. There is simply a never-ending stream of good news about vegetarian foods. In the words of Natalie Angier of the New York Times, the truth is that the more researchers understand about the ingredients found in fruits, vegetables, beans, and herbs, the more impressed they are with the power of those compounds to retard the bodily breakdown that results in cancer and other chronic diseases. But you never hear any good news about meat. You never switch on the news to learn that a medical study at Harvard has revealed that roast beef boosts the immune system, or that fried chicken helps prevent arthritis, or that ham is good for the prostate. There's never a single encouraging news tidbit about veal, say, aiding the gonads. Nothing positive ever turns up, even about the highly regarded turkey escalops fontina. There is simply never anything health-enhancing that any researcher can uncover about flesh foods. Meanwhile, a torrent of revelations confirms the benefits of plant foods. Although it is rare for anybody in the media to note it, you've got to be blind not to see a pattern. Take the case of homocysteine, an amino acid derived from the breakdown of another amino acid, methionine, present in greater proportion in animal than vegetable protein. In the early 1960s, a rare disease called homocystinuria was discovered in Ireland. Victims may suffer a variety of ailments, including mental retardation, but all cases are characterized by elevated levels of homocysteine in the blood and urine, and hardening of the arteries. This discovery led to the hypothesis that perhaps homocysteine, rather than cholesterol, is the active agent in breaking down the lining of the arteries. Recently, evidence has mounted that indeed serum homocysteine levels mirror risk of cardiac arrest. Homocysteine is broken down by vitamin B6 and folic acid, both abundantly present in plant foods. Proponents of the homocysteine hypothesis point to the ratio between methionine and vitamin B6 in foods as the crucial factor for arterial health, finding this ratio worrisome in animal foods and ideal in fruits and vegetables. And so the debate in the medical community between the cholesterol model of arterial disease and the homocysteine model shakes out this way. Those in the medical majority who emphasize the risk of elevated serum cholesterol as a cause of heart disease must by logic concede that the optimal diet is a low-fat, zero-cholesterol diet, a vegan diet. Those in the medical minority who, by contrast, emphasize the risk factor of elevated homocysteine in the blood must by logic concede that the optimal diet is the one lowest in methionine and highest in folic acid and vitamin B6, a vegan diet. The scientific debate between the cholesterol model and the homocysteine model of heart disease essentially boils down to no more than an argument about which does the most damage, saturated fat and cholesterol from animal foods or animal protein itself. In practical dietary terms, it is a distinction without a difference. If you decide to follow all the arrows and move to a vegetarian or vegan diet, you will most likely encounter some resistance from others who lack your insight or courage to change. Some people may say that you're a fool. Don't worry about it. You'll outlive them. Other vegetarian fools include Plato, Socrates, Einstein, Tolstoy, Thoreau, Emerson, Franklin, Pope, Newton, Pythagoras, Gandhi, Da Vinci, Voltaire, Milton, Darwin, Schweitzer, Shelley, Shaw, Paul McCartney, and last but not least, Madonna. Some may say that you're too extreme, that you're better off just cutting down on meat products instead of going vegetarian. But if something's unhealthy for your body, by what logic would it be better to ingest a moderate amount of it than to eliminate it altogether? Some who are ignorant of the facts may tell you that you can't get enough protein on a vegetarian diet, but as we know, most Americans suffer from an unhealthy excess of protein. You will have absolutely no problem getting sufficient protein on a balanced vegetarian diet. Other naysayers may warn you that you're likely to become anemic. In fact, most vegetarians have very healthy hemoglobin levels. Only those who eat a diet of junk foods and dairy products, which are iron deficient, may run into problems. Some skeptics may bring up the cloudier matter of vitamin B12. It's a fact that only animal foods contain substantial quantities of this vitamin. The human need for vitamin B12 is minuscule, about 2 micrograms per day, and our bodies store the vitamin for a period of years. Vitamin B12 is manufactured by bacteria and other one-celled organisms, and therefore our ancestors probably got plenty of it when they ate root vegetables and plants without washing off all the soil. Naturally, I don't suggest not washing your vegetables. There are plenty of easy ways for a vegan to obtain B12. Some scientists believe that we get adequate levels of B12 from intestinal bacteria and bacteria in the environment, but to be conservative, I recommend supplemental B12. Many cereals, soy milks, and other packaged foods are enriched with B12. Nutritional yeast and textured vegetable protein are also good sources. Finally, all multivitamins, including vegetarian formulas, contain more B12 than you will ever need. So vitamin B12 deficiency, which can lead to pernicious anemia, is nothing to worry about, even on a strictly vegan diet. But to be perfectly safe, simply enrich your diet with supplements. nursing mothers should take particular care to do so. Finally, there is what I consider the argument of last resort against vegetarianism. It is an argument that dismisses the facts in favor of supposition. Never mind the statistics about heart attacks and cancer. Never mind that vegetarians tend to live longer than meat eaters. Never mind the obesity that is the common result of an animal-based diet. Never mind all the environmental reasons for a diet that is plant-based. Humans were meant to be meat eaters, some plead. We evolved as hunters. We have canine teeth. You can't find nature. You can't fight nature. We have bloodlust. The reality, thankfully, is otherwise. We are not inexplicably doomed by nature to a diet that destroys our bodies. Evolution created many carnivores, such as the lion, dog, wolf, and cat. They all have a short digestive system, roughly three times the length of their bodies, to facilitate the speedy removal of decaying flesh, which can poison the bloodstream if it lingers too long in the body. Carnivores also differ from herbivores in having acidic saliva and stomachs with large amounts of hydrochloric acid, useful in digesting flesh and bones. Animals who hunt at night and sleep by day don't need sweat glands, and so don't perspire through their skin. Instead, they sweat through their tongues. And carnivores, of course, have claws, powerful jaws, and long, sharp canine teeth to tear living flesh. They do not possess molars needed for grinding their food or the enzyme ptyalin for pre-digesting grain. How do humans compare in these regards? The answer is not new to science. It was given long ago by Plutarch, who pointed out that man has no curved beak, no sharp talons or claws, no pointed teeth. On the contrary, by the smoothness of his teeth, the small capacity of his mouth, the softness of his tongue, and the sluggishness of his digestive apparatus, nature sternly forbids him to feed on flesh. Plutarch was right. Like our cousins, the anthropoid apes, whose diet consists mostly of fruit and nuts, our digestive system is 12 times the length of our bodies. It takes meat 5 days to take this voyage and pass out of the body. Vegetarian food, 1 to 2 days. Our skin has pores for evaporation, and our stomach acid has roughly 5% the strength of the carnivores. Obviously, we have neither claws nor powerful carnivorous jaws, but have molars for grinding and pre-digesting our grain. Like herbivorous animals, we have alkaline saliva and the enzyme ptyalin to pre-digest grain. The teeth we call our canines have only the name in common with the long, sharp, piercing teeth of dogs or tigers. If you don't believe me, try using your canines to tear into the living flesh of a moose. I have challenged many people to do so, and not one has come back with the moose in his mouth. Do we have bloodlust? Well, does the idea of tearing a chicken or a cow apart with your hands and teeth and sucking its warm blood appeal to you? People eat their meat packaged and disguised precisely because the reality of eating flesh disgusts most of us. Maybe there's a reason for that. And that brings us to the end of chapter 8. So we'll go ahead and read the last chapter. Chapter 9, Going Home. I have been on the road for the last several years, traveling up to 100,000 miles a year, speaking to anyone who will listen about the health benefits of a vegetarian diet and the dangers posed to our land and our bodies by chemical agriculture. I've spoken in nearly every state, with one notable exception. Montana was never on my itinerary. I suppose that's at least partly because there's not a great demand for vegetarian speakers in Montana, but it's also the case that I wasn't real eager to go home. I love the state, and I miss my old friends there, yet something in my gut was telling me not to return, that I'd find it too painful. I went back while writing this book and saw what my gut was warning me about. Family farming in the Montana that I knew is not just dying, as I had feared, it is dead. All the familiar small dairies, many with histories spanning several generations, have closed. I visited my old friend Harry Mitchell, who had once been the proprietor of the largest, most successful dairy farm in Montana, Ayrshire Dairy. Most successful dairy farm in Montana, Ayrshire Dairy. When I was a child, the only other dairy of comparable size in the state was the Lyman Dairy. Today, his farm is devoid of livestock and deathly quiet. If Harry Mitchell, the most hardworking, skillful, knowledgeable farmer you'd ever want to meet, can't run a dairy profitably today, no one can. All the farmers and former farmers with whom I spoke had an edge of despair in their voices as they discussed the condition of agriculture in Montana and across the nation. There was no joy left in farming. Competing against agribusinesses, giant feedlots, mega dairies, all of which have taken every possible advantage of their size and rigged government policy to favor themselves, none of the family farmers truly had a chance. Government farm subsidies, often too complex for any single human to understand, have long tended to favor large-scale agriculture. Dairies in southern states, which don't have the expense of keeping their cows warm, have exploited their natural advantage over those in the northern states. The failures of chemical agriculture, meanwhile, have drawn most farmers deeper and deeper into a financial pit as their soil has grown less productive. For all these reasons, more Montanan family farmers are throwing in the towel every week. Many are selling their land for housing developments or golf courses. Tourism is quickly replacing agriculture as the leading industry in the state, and the plight of Montana's small farmers is echoed across the land. When I sold my farm in 1983, there were about 1,250,000 full-time commercial family farms in America. Today, about 400,000 remain. At this rate, the family farmer will be virtually extinct within a decade. Family farmers are easier to lose than to replace. I would be a hypocrite if I claimed to feel unmitigated grief for the decline of dairies that, after all, yield a product that I now believe to be counterproductive to human health. But I do lament deeply the passing of a way of life, the rending of the fabric of community across rural America. And I feel for the small farmers who are losing out to the same high-tech, high-input chemical means of production that is increasingly the bane of consumers, taxpayers, and the land itself. With a lump in my throat, I headed back to the old family homestead. It was raining, and I trudged through the muddy soil around the fossilized remains of the sheds, granaries, scale houses, loading chutes, corrals, and feed bunks that I had once built. It was tough. Tough to feel that a lifetime of work and energy and heartbreak had gone into creating something that now is overgrown with weeds. Tough to realize that maybe if I had gone about it the right way, it would still be a productive, flourishing farm today. I visited the cemetery where my parents and my brother are buried. My father's headstone is the size of a large refrigerator. The stone was rubbed smooth by buffalo that had brushed up against it for ages before cattle usurped them upon the land. My father had pointed the stone out to me when I was about 15. "You see that big old rock over there? That's what I want for my headstone." He never said another word about it, and neither did I. 35 years later, when he died, I made sure his wish was carried out. It's one of the few things back home that I got right. I looked up the fellows I used to play poker with. Of the other 9 men who were all about my age, I am 59, 4 are dead, 3 of heart disease, 1 of emphysema. 3 live with heart disease, 1 has battled colon cancer, and another has survived cancer of the prostate. I'm the only one in good health. It seemed as if heart disease and cancer had visited practically every family I dropped in on. Everyone I spoke to was curious about my eating habits, but they were discreet. A pattern developed. Nobody wanted to ask me too many questions about my vegetarian diet in public, But whenever my friends cornered me alone, they pumped me for information. What do I have for dinner on a vegetarian diet? Fish? How do I get enough protein? My friends suffered from a lot of misinformation, but they knew something was seriously wrong with the way they were eating. Too many people were obese, too many were sick, too many had already died. The plague of the animal-based diet had wreaked havoc on their families and their community. They knew in their hearts that it was time to change. They just didn't know how. In sum, change inspires fear. What would happen to the economy, one friend challenged me, if I had my way and the nation went vegetarian? What would happen to all the jobs in the meat industry? They would be lost, of course. Gone would be all the jobs in the slaughterhouses, the most dangerous jobs in America, as well as all the other foul jobs in meat processing, not to mention all the minimum wage jobs flipping burgers. They would be replaced by even more jobs, safer, cleaner, more satisfying, and probably better paying jobs in the production and selling of organic, healthy, plant-based products. The savings in medical costs attributable to meat consumption, estimated at $28 to $61 billion annually, would be plowed back into our economy and boost its productivity enormously. Organic farming is labor-intensive and more conducive to small farming operations than large. That is why the loss of a generation of family farmers troubles me greatly. We need skilled farmers to help sustain the transition to small-scale organic agriculture that just happens to be the fastest-growing segment of the farm economy today. And organic agriculture thrives without imposing hidden costs on taxpayers the way the chicken and hog and cattle operations do when their waste products run off into our waterways. I think of the words of my friend Fred Kirschenman, who runs a prosperous organic farm in North Dakota. Quote, "My neighbors outproduce me in just about every respect but one," Fred says, "net profit. He has far lower input costs than the chemical farmers, and consumers wisely are willing to pay more for his goods." The change is underway. I paid a visit to the largest commercial supermarket in Great Falls. I could hardly believe my eyes. Soy milk and rice milk on the shelves, soy hot dogs, veggie burgers, tofu, and seitan, and I found vegetarian entrees in all the restaurants I sampled. It's not hard anymore to be a vegetarian in America. If it can be done in Great Falls, it can be done anywhere. The question we must ask ourselves as a culture is whether we want to embrace the change that must come or resist it. Are we so attached to the dietary fallacies with which we were raised, so afraid to counter the arbitrary laws of eating taught to us in childhood by our misinformed parents, that we cannot alter the course they set us on, even if it leads to our own ruin? Does the prospect of standing apart or encountering ridicule scare us, even from saving ourselves? That prospect intimidated me once, and I can only wonder now what I was frightened of. It's hard to imagine now that I am 130 pounds lighter, infinitely healthier, more full of life and energy, much happier. Now that I have vegetarian friends wherever I go and feel part of a movement that is not so much political as it is a march of the human heart. Now that I understand how much is at stake, now that I've come to relish shaking people up. I would love to see the meat industry and the pesticide industry shaken up too. I would love to see feedlots close and factory farming end. I would love to see more families return to the land, grow crops for our own species, and raise them organically. I would love to see farm communities revive. I would love to know that I've wandered into my nation's heartland by the sweet smell of grain and not the forbidding smell of excrement. I can no longer fathom what there is to be afraid of, except the status quo. How do we want in the end to measure the lives we have led? We could measure them, of course, according to how much money and how many material possessions we've accumulated. But in the words made famous by a great American play, you can't take it with you. Or we could ask ourselves, have we done all that we could do for the generations to come? Are there more trees now than there were when we were born? Is the air fresher? Is the water cleaner? Is there more good, rich farmland? Are there more birds in the sky? More fish in the sea? Are there more animals in the wild? Are people leading longer, healthier lives? Is there less hunger? Is there less disease and suffering? Is the world a more peaceful place? When you can't take it with you, all that really matters is what you leave behind. And that brings us to the end of Mad Cowboy, Plain Truth from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat, written by the great Howard Lyman. And now from plant-based news, a story titled A Star-Studded Animated Animal Farm Adaptation just hit cinemas. This new Animal Farm film has been in development for nearly 15 years. This article was written by the editorial team of Plant-Based News. A new star-studded animated Animal Farm adaptation just arrived in cinemas, the latest adaptation of George Orwell's seminal 1945 novella is titled Animal Farm, A Cautionary Tale, and was written by Nicholas Stoller. The cast of Animal Farm, A Cautionary Tale includes Seth Rogen, Gaten Matarazzo, Steve Buscemi, Glenn Close, Laverne Cox, Kieran Culkin, Kathleen Turner, and acclaimed vegan actor Woody Harrelson. The film was directed and produced by Andy Serkis, who is still best known for his award-winning motion capture work, but has pivoted towards acting and directing. Animal Farm, A Cautionary Tale is the fourth feature film he has directed. As in the classic novella, the film follows a group of anthropomorphic farmed animals who overthrow their human captors and create a new system of governance, which eventually fails due to the corruption that leadership and power bring. To Orwell, farmed animals were more than just a literary tool. In the introduction to the Ukrainian edition of Animal Farm, George Orwell described once seeing a young boy whipping a huge cart horse whenever he tried to turn. It struck me that if only such animals became aware of their strength, we should have no power over them, and that men exploit animals in much the same way as the rich exploit the proletariat, Orwell wrote. Animal Farm, A Cautionary Tale was released on May 1st, 2026. It premiered at BFI London Film Festival and the Annecy International Animation Film Festival in 2025. According to Angel Studios, the owner of Animal Farm, A Cautionary Tale's U.S. distribution rights, the film retains the original's satirical allegory of revolution and power and fulfills Orwell's warning about the dangers of communism. Orwell's Animal Farm notably featured an anti-Stalinist message. However, it also reflected how all systems of power, including capitalism and religion, can potentially lead to oppression in a reflection of the author's unilateral anti-authoritarianism. Angel Studios is based in Provo, Utah, and is primarily associated with so-called values-based entertainment. Its productions often feature Christian themes. Here's a story from Sentient Media titled, Cancer Rates Are Higher Near Factory Farms, Study Finds, written by Emily Payne. In California, Texas, and Iowa, cancer rates are 4 to 8% higher in areas with more industrial animal agriculture. People living near higher densities of factory farms may face increased cancer risk, a new study finds. While the public health and environmental impacts of concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, are well documented, the investigation is among the first to examine links to cancer across multiple U.S. regions and cancer types. Researchers at Yale University analyzed county-level cancer rates from 2000 to 2021 in Iowa, Texas, and California, comparing areas with high concentrations of factory farms to similar counties with few. They found that overall cancer incidence rates were significantly elevated in counties with more animal feeding operations. Factory farms produce massive amounts of manure. Iowa's hogs alone produce an estimated 110 billion pounds of manure each year, at least 100 times the amount of fecal waste created by Iowa's entire human population. Nearly all of the hogs in Iowa are raised in CAFOs, typically stored in large outdoor ponds called lagoons. CAFO manure generates harmful amounts of air pollutants, including ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, and particulate matter, and contaminated runoff leads to pathogens and nitrates leaching into local waterways. A recent report from the Iowa Environmental Council and the Harkin Institute found that high levels of environmental contaminants, including nitrates, are linked to cancer risk and are ubiquitous across Iowa. The state has the second highest and fastest rising cancer rate in the United States. Iowa oncologist Dr. Richard Deming, a co-author of the report, says that it aligns with the Yale study. When you know the relationship between CAFOs and nitrates that get into the water, it doesn't surprise me that it's another study that supports the data, he says. The Yale study researchers found positive associations between animal feeding operation density and rates of almost all cancers. Counties with many industrial farms had a higher overall cancer incidence rate than control counties, 4% higher in California and 8% higher in both Iowa and Texas. Some cancer types showed stronger correlations than others, but Deming explains that this variability is expected when looking at environmental risk factors. Cancers might not appear for decades after environmental exposure, and these exposures also interact with genetics and known risk factors like tobacco use, diet, exercise levels, and alcohol consumption. It would be easier to explain the data if nitrates only cause one cancer, and that you could just track that, and there were a parallel association between nitrates and one cancer, says Deming. The way cancer develops, it doesn't happen that way. There are also complex socioeconomic factors at play that make it difficult to directly link cancer cases to CAFO pollution, says Anne Scheschinger, Senior Director of Agriculture and Climate Research at the advocacy nonprofit Environmental Working Group. It's especially tricky in rural counties to tie something specific to increased rates of cancer because we know rural counties oftentimes have less preventative health care access, lower incomes, higher age, says Scheschinger. The Yale study researchers ran statistical analysis to pair similar counties based on factors including race and ethnicity, education level, income, age, smoking, and urban versus rural status. They use the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency definition of animal feeding operations, facilities where animals are kept and fed in a confined area for at least 45 days within a 12-month period without any crops or vegetation growing there. CAFOs are animal feeding operations that meet a certain size threshold, such as at least 700 dairy cattle, 2,500 swine, or 100,000 laying hens. The EPA requires large CAFOs to hold a permit to regulate their water pollution. But in 2024, fewer than one-third of the nation's CAFOs held these permits. All other facilities that don't require this permit, which represent the vast majority of animal feeding operations in the U.S., may or may not be regulated at the state level, depending on their location. Because of this, Scheschinger says that looking at permitting data alone does not capture the full scale of animal feeding operations in the U.S. Quote, especially in a state like Iowa, the data that they got from the DNR, Iowa Department of Natural Resources, is not going to represent all of the animal facilities, says Scheschinger of the Yale study. She notes that identifying smaller facilities, which can still house thousands of animals, and regulating them at the state level could help mitigate the public health impact of animal feeding operations. For Deming, the study's results are a call for investment in data collection at a time when researchers are facing reduced funding. Collecting data like on nitrates in the water, that requires some real field work. And as we understand that we need to be doing more of that, the state of Iowa is starting to not fund the collection of that data, says Deming. In 2023, the Iowa legislature cut funding for the Iowa Nutrient Research Center, which tracks real-time water quality data, including nitrate levels in the state's waterways. State and local public health officials also need to be empowered to look at the impacts of factory farming, says Dr. Naaman Shah, an epidemiologist at the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. Factory farms are typically not under the purview of public health departments, despite their documented public health impacts. The more and more we learn about the health impacts of these businesses, we need a change in regulatory code that really centers the public health responsibility, which is about protecting the population in nearby communities, says Shaw. Compared to where it's traditionally been with the Department of Agriculture, which has just a very different mandate, including promotion of the industry. Another story from Sentient Media today is titled "The Gelatin Trick: Clean Image, Industrial Reality," written by Jessica Scott Reed. Gelatin has made a comeback thanks to, quote, natural wellness trends, despite modest evidence for its effectiveness and ongoing concerns about where it comes from. Known as America's most favorite dessert at the turn of the 20th century, jiggly bright Jell-O was once a symbol of modernity and food innovation. Into the 1950s, the brand of gelatin mixes became a fixture of American life with molded desserts and salads, also called aspics, centering tables and celebrated as fun, convenient, and versatile. But as consumers grew wary of processed foods, Jell-O fell from its mid-century dominance, with sales steadily dropping since the 1980s. Now, American food politics and wellness culture are shifting again. Today, the main ingredient of Jell-O, gelatin, is seeing a surge in popularity and sales, bolstered in part by social media influencers who promote its supposed nutritional and functional benefits. The trend follows in the footsteps of collagen and tallow as part of the broader high-protein and, quote, natural wellness craze. But TikTok's viral gelatin trick and natural Botox are far from natural. And questions trail the trend about how this industry impacts the environment and animal welfare. Gelatin then and now. Gelatin's story begins far before its role as a household favorite of the 1950s. One of the earliest written records appeared in Baghdad, where a 10th century Arabic cookbook held a written description of extracting a gel-like substance from boiling fish heads. However, Denis Papin of France is most commonly cited as the first person to produce gelatin in 1681 by boiling animal bones. According to historical records, Papin developed an early version of the pressure cooker, known as a digester, to soften bones and extract the gel-forming material that he suggested using as a food source. By the Victorian era, gelatin had become a food of the upper class. Fancy gelatin molds became a status symbol reserved for royalty and the wealthy. What appeared posh and refined on the table was, in fact, the product of significant human labor and animal use. Before factory farming, industrial production, and powdered mixes, gelatin had to be painstakingly extracted from animal parts such as calves' feet in a slow process carried out by cooks and other servants. The popularity of gelatin has ebbed and flowed over recent decades, and today it has some unusual food applications beyond gelled, synthetically colored desserts, though jellied salads are also making a comeback. Some social media users are now promoting an edible homemade Botox, often made with a mixture of common quote, clean foods and beverages such as fruit juice, green tea, yogurt, or honey, along with the odorless, tasteless gelatin, which is derived from collagen. Others are promoting the same recipes as a technique for weight loss, sharing recipes for gelatin squares they claim are filling and can prevent overeating. For the most part, these claims overstate the evidence. While some evidence suggests gelatin consumption can support collagen production, the effects are modest, and researchers note that the body processes collagen just like any other protein. The nutrition source at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health points out that high protein foods of many kinds, including soy and other legumes, not just animal sources, provides the amino acids needed to produce collagen, and that natural collagen production is supported through a healthy and balanced diet. The nutrition source also notes that there is a lack of research to show that eating collagen can directly benefit skin or joint health. This is echoed in a 2025 Allure magazine story on eating gelatin gummies for better skin, which tells readers, don't fall for this nonsense. And though some studies suggest eating gelatin can modestly increase feelings of fullness, there is little evidence that it leads to sustained weight loss. Consuming gelatin cannot burn fat nor boost metabolism. Solid market of murky origins. Though it may be touted as, quote, clean and natural on TikTok, gelatin production begins most commonly on factory farms where animals are raised in intensive confinement. After being sent to slaughter, certain parts of those animals that are less commonly eaten, including pig skins, cattle bones, tissues, and connective tissues, as well as fish skin and scales, are cleaned and boiled to break down the byproducts into collagen, then treated with an acid or alkali to extract gelatin, which is then filtered, concentrated, and dried. In addition to foods including candies and marshmallows, gelatin is a common ingredient in a broad range of products such as medications, beauty products, adhesives, and photographic materials. And the market for it is booming. The global gelatin market is experiencing a period of robust growth, according to market research. In the United States, the gelatin market is projected to grow significantly to an estimated value of $602.32 million by 2032. But concerns persist about the ingredient's reliance on factory farming operations that are tied to high greenhouse gas emissions, extensive land and water use, in addition to mass animal slaughter. A report on the food-grade gelatin market for 2026 to 2035 identifies concerns over factory farming practices and the environmental footprint of gelatin production as part of the challenges facing the gelatin industry. The report shares that these issues, combined with a lack of transparency in gelatin sourcing, continue to challenge the market's reputation and growth potential. Bottom line, from royal dining rooms to mid-century molded salads to today's wellness trends, gelatin has been continually reshaped to match the culture of the moment. Its latest rebrand as the, quote, natural health aid reflects a broader shift in food culture, one that seems to blur the realities of its source. For all its shifting identities, gelatin is a product of industrial animal agriculture, dependent on systems that raise persistent concerns about environmental impacts and animal welfare. And Veg News gives us this interesting article. A new blue zone? Tanzania joins the ranks of the world's healthiest diets. This was written by Charlotte Poynting. New research suggests that following a more traditional Tanzanian Kilimanjaro-style plant-forward diet may boost health and immunity. Thanks to growing research and reports in recent years, there's increasing global recognition that the Mediterranean diet, rich in fruits, vegetables, grains, legumes, and beans, and low in meat, is among the healthiest ways to eat. It is the eating pattern followed by people in Icaria, Greece, and Sardinia, Italy, for example, which are two of the world's blue zones, regions renowned for longevity. The other blue zones in Loma Linda, California, Nicoya, Costa Rica, and Okinawa, Japan, also emphasize plants and very little meat, as well as moderate exercise, a purposeful life, and a full social circle. As the blue zones demonstrate, a plant-heavy diet seems to come with an abundance of benefits. Research suggests that due to their antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties, plant-based whole foods may help reduce the risk of a myriad of diseases that plague the Western world, including heart disease, cancer, and dementia. Ultra-processed foods, on the other hand, seem to do the opposite, increasing the risk of common chronic diseases. But new research suggests the blue zones and the Mediterranean regions of the world are far from alone in adopting a plant-heavy diet. A new study published in the journal Nature focused not on the Mediterranean, Asia, or South America, but Africa. It found that those in Tanzania, specifically who eat the way their ancestors ate, more plants and less meat, are far healthier than those who follow a more Western-style diet. This study is yet another reminder that the foundations of many traditional diets, whole grains, legumes, fruits, vegetables, and fermented foods, support health in a variety of ways. Sapna Paravuemba, MSRDN of Health by Sapna, told Veg News. It's often when people move away from traditional patterns toward more modern Western diets that we see increases in chronic disease risks. The benefits of the Tanzanian Kilimanjaro diet. The new study consisted of two groups of men from Tanzania, totaling around 77 people. Half the men followed a traditional rural Kilimanjaro heritage-style diet, which is high in foods like okra, plantains, beans, and drinks like mbege, which is made with fermented banana and millet. The other half followed a more Western-style diet full of processed foods like sausages, white bread, and French fries. Researchers found that the men who switched from the rural diet to the urban diet showed elevated levels of inflammatory proteins in their bodies, markers of metabolic dysregulation, and a reduced immune response. However, those who moved from urban diets to more traditional rural foods experienced the opposite effect. The researchers noted that these health impacts were still detectable 4 weeks after the study, showing that diet changes can have long-lasting effects. Our study highlights the benefits of these traditional food products for inflammation and metabolic processes in the body, said lead author and infectious disease specialist Quirgin Damast from the Netherlands, Radboud University Medical Center. At the same time, we show how harmful an unhealthy Western diet can be. Paravuemba agrees that in general, ultra-processed foods can be detrimental to our health. This is largely because they've been stripped of protective nutrients, she says. Think fiber, which is essential for gut and digestive health, as well as antioxidants and phytochemicals, which repair cell damage and reduce inflammation. Instead, ultra-processed foods can often contain high amounts of sugar and sodium and even carcinogens. Processed and red meats like sausages are especially problematic. They're high in saturated fats and contain compounds like carnitine, which can fuel inflammation and harm cardiovascular health, explains Paravuemba. They're also classified as group 1 carcinogens by the World Health Organization, meaning there's strong evidence linking them to cancer. The Kilimanjaro heritage diet is not just rich in antioxidants and fiber, but thanks to fermented drinks like mbegege, it is high in gut-friendly probiotics too. It's worth noting that this drink is alcoholic, adds Paravuemba. So any probiotic benefits may be counteracted by alcohol's known pro-inflammatory and carcinogenic effects. For anyone who wants to reap the benefits of the rural Tanzanian diet, Paravuemba recommends building meals around vegetables and legumes, snacking on fruit and eating more whole grains, as well as opting for more fermented foods like sauerkraut or kimchi, for example, don't underestimate the power of returning to the basics, she adds. Whether that means embracing your own cultural food roots or simply prioritizing more whole plant foods in your meals, these shifts can make a big difference. And to bring Animalia Hour to a close for today, I'd like to share a quote that was posted on Instagram on the account The Undisputable Vegans. This quote was said by Mike Anderson. We kill billions of wild animals to protect the animals we eat. We then destroy our environment to feed the animals we eat. We spend more time, money, and resources fattening the animals we eat than we do feeding humans who are actually starving. The greatest irony is that after all the expense of raising these animals, we eat them and they kill us. And instead of recognizing this insanity, we torture and kill millions of other animals trying to find a cure to the diseases caused by eating animals in the first place. When it comes to eating, humans are without question the dumbest animals on the planet. Thank you so much for listening to Animalia Hour today. We are encouraging you to try transitioning to a plant-based diet. You have nothing to lose, and the planet has everything to gain. Have a good day. We hope you enjoyed today's installment of Animalia Hour with me, Sarah Hale. We'll be back next week with more news and stories. Wishing you a gorgeous day. Bye.